Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 14th of September. Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, always a Sunday must-read column in the New York Times, Maureen Dowd is with us this hour. She has a new book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. She starts the book by saying, when you've lived through extraordinary history, watching a president get impeached, covering father-son presidencies, chronicling a cooked-up war, seeing the wacky woman from Wasilla go rogue, savoring the election of the first black commander-in-chief, you don't expect to be exponentially more astonished, but then America got mad and went mad. Her latest book is good reading for this almost time to vote. The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. Maureen is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the New York Times and also a best-selling author. She won the Pulitzer for her series of columns on the Clinton impeachment and Monica Lewinsky scandals. She has covered 9 presidential races now for the New York Times. She is an extraordinarily talented writer, and we're delighted to have her with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls in a little while, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Maureen Dowd, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Yeah, thanks so much. America got mad, and have we ever gone mad? Oh, my.
I know, it's so amazing. I never thought I would see an election that was as amazing as 2008, because it had gender and race and a young prince usurping a queen.
Right.
But this one, you know, that may have been Shakespeare. This is Cirque du Soleil, you know. This is the wildest 56 days we're ever going to see, and possibly the meanest.
Yeah, I know. Well, and you saw both of them when they were a little milder. I want to go back for a little bit to 1999, when you were on Donald Trump's plane, and you can tell us about what's on the plane, as he was looking at his first presidential run, perhaps, his first presidential rope line, right?
Yeah, I guess that was actually maybe the first lie he ever told me.
Really?
We're on the plane, and it has all this guilt, and it has a double bed, and it has Melania, who he was dating at that point, and it has French Impressionist paintings. And I said, well, those can't be real, right, because of the altitude. It would ruin them. And he's like, oh, yes, it's real. But, of course, they weren't real. So he was going to Miami to test the waters with a speech to Cuban Americans to see if he should run, and Roger Stone was with us, and he approached the rope line, and he was very shy about it and sort of scampered away and didn't think about it for a few more years. And every few years he would think about trying to be a politician, and then finally this year, you know, he was 69 when he started, so he just decided he was going to go for it.
Mm-hmm. What is his thing with these beautiful women and, you know, sizing up a woman's breasts and talking about them, and where did that come from? Is it from, somebody said recently, it was from his grandfather, who ran kind of a brothel in Washington many years ago, that all of the Trump men have gone after these women with, you know, models with big breasts, and he really does brag about it.
Yeah, I always think that I don't, you know, it's almost like Leonardo DiCaprio. When if a guy goes out with one Victoria's Secret model, that's fine. But if that's all they ever go out with,
right,
I just figure that's a sign of insecurity to me. I mean, Melania is actually a very lovely person. She has a really nice aura to her. I liked her when I met her that time in 99. We were hanging out, and she's kind of a cool person. This is nothing against her. But, you know, there is something odd about, you know, his friends say he does have that kind of genetic superiority thing where you want to marry someone who looks really good so your children will look really good, and, you know, not too much emphasis on the brains, all on the looks.
Mm-hmm. I love this comment you write in the book, which I hadn't heard before. You asked him about how Bill Clinton handled the Monica affair, and he said disgracefully, they would have been more forgiving if he'd had affairs with a really beautiful woman of sophistication. Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe were on a different level.
That's funny. That's true. But also in the same conversation, I asked him about Monica, and he was very sweet about her. He said, you know, she's been through a hard time, and everyone should leave her alone. So just when you think he's kind of a rat pack, chauvinist pig, he does something kind of nice for women. Like, he was the first one to help women break through the barrier on construction. He put this woman, Barbara Reese, in charge of, you know, construction projects against the wishes of his father. And he was one of the first ones to do that and trust a woman. And he said to me, I think in that same column, he said that he gets along better with women, and women are harder on him, and he kind of trusts them more in some way. So, you know, yes, you can miniaturize and caricature him just based on the Howard Stern comment,
right.
But there's a little bit more to it than that. He's always treated me in a very professional way. He's never cut me off, even when I've been critical of him. So it's a little more complicated.
Yeah. The two of you talk on the phone. I know you visited him at Trump Tower and interviewed him there, but you have phone conversations with Donald Trump?
Well, I have done both, but as you know, all of that could end at any second.
Yes.
I mean,
right.
I can walk out of this building and he could tweet that he's done with me. You know, so he is a 70-year-old high chair king, and he could throw his applesauce at me at any moment.
Well, you won the Pulitzer for your columns on the Clinton impeachment and Monica Lewinsky scandals. How did the Clintons handle Monica Lewinsky? Remind us.
Well, the Clintons got in a bad habit of denying and trashing women who truthfully said they were involved with Bill Clinton and demonizing them.
Mm-hmm.
With Jennifer Flowers, they would start by denying, and then and Monica, and if they couldn't deny, with Jennifer Flowers and Paula Jones, James Carville made that famous remark about if you dragged a dollar through a trailer park, and, you know, they would try and treat them as sort of low class. And with Monica, the White House kind of tried to paint her as a troubled kind of stalker fantasist. And, you know, the reason this was so offensive was because the Clintons, like all Democrats, were very much on the side of Anita Hill, who David Brock and others painted as a little nutty and a little slutty. But then David Brock came over to the Clinton side, but then they were trying to paint Monica as a little nutty and a little slutty.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they would do things to get Bill off the hook. And actually, you've hit on my main problem with the Clintons, which is it's always a Faustian bargain with them. You have to accept the bad to get the good. And I don't like having that gun to my head. So with Monica, you know, if you wanted Bill's progressive policies toward women, you had to accept his retrogressive attitude toward having affairs and humiliating his wife. And now, you know, with Hillary, if you want to get the Supreme Court, you want the liberal Supreme Court, you have to accept all her mishigas about the email server and the foundation. It's like, put up with all our stuff if you want the policies that we are able to give you. So Hillary has always had this side where she's a great public servant who wants to change the world in good ways, but then somewhere along the line she got into making a lot of decisions from a place of fear and insecurity, and that causes like bad things, secretiveness and defensiveness and misleading and appearing and disappearing records.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two things always come together.
What is the story with the Clintons and money, Maureen? You write that she's shrouded in a miasma of money grabs and conveniently disappearing records and emails, but the money grabs are incredibly substantial, and I had forgotten until I was reading your book of the things that were taken from the White House, and they had to pay back money, and then she got all these gifts when she was out of the White House for a while and was a senator-elect. I mean, they've always been after huge, huge amounts of money.
Well, you know, Bob Woodward said to me once that every president gets the shrink they deserve, but being a shrink for Trump and the Clintons is very hard, because it's very hard to sort through their different pathologies. And I have, in the book, I have this reporting I did, which at the time people thought was a satire, but it wasn't a satire. Right when she was a senator-elect and she was leaving the White House as First Lady, a bunch of Hollywood women were solicited, and other donors were solicited for like $5,000 apiece to have almost a bridal shower at Borsheim's, which is a Warren Buffett store in Omaha, so she could furnish her Washington house, which was then going to be set up to, you know, have donors and get the future run going. So silver ladles and this kind of thing. And, you know, so in a way, it technically was not breaking any rules,
right,
but it was eluding the spirit of the ethics ban, where you really shouldn't be giving to incoming senators, you know, to where you might get favors. And then at the same time, they kind of ran off with a lot of gifts to the White House that had been meant for the White House and not them, and ended up having to pay back, you know, $80,000 or something. And so it's just strange with the Clintons that they have this graspiness. It's funny, epitomized by the fact that I think they were worth $150 million between the books and the speeches. And yet, even though she's wanted to be president her whole life, she still needed that extra $675,000 from a couple
right.
Goldman Sachs speeches.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why do that on the cusp of a job you've wanted your whole life? You don't, even if they spend a lot of money every day, they would never be able to spend all their money. Plus, if she's president, she's going to make another huge amount of money doing memoirs and stuff. So I don't understand the insecurity that leads her to blur these ethical lines. They don't need the money.
What do they do with all their money?
That's what I don't understand. I really don't get it. You know, I've been reading biographies of her all weekend to try and understand it. And admittedly, her mother had a hard time and
yes.
grew up in poverty, and she did not have a lot of money. There was a famous story when he was governor of Arkansas where she wanted to build a pool, and his advisors had to go to her and say, no, this is Arkansas. The governor's mansion can have a pool. And she resented it because at a certain point she wanted the perks and the money that she would have had if she was in the private sector while she was doing public service. You know, one of her
right.
top aides had a great quote about her once where he said, she's like an Episcopal minister who wants to do good works while living at the same level as her parishioners.
Right. Well, now a pool, that's the only thing. If I will never make a lot of money, but if I had a lot of money, I've always thought I would put a pool in and then I'd give the rest of it away. But a pool is something else, don't you think, Maureen?
It was only because it was Arkansas.
I understand.
So,
yeah.
You know, if she had been the wife of the governor of California, it would have been fine. But it was just not appropriate at that moment in Arkansas. Yeah.
All right, let's move to Donald Trump. I can't believe this election. Oh, my gosh. His scant
Wild.
Impulse control, you write. He's willing to say the most insulting, provocative things that people would say. They wouldn't say at a dinner party, much less a global forum. Will he get into a tweet battle with a madman and start a world war? And you're not saying that facetiously. I mean, will he do that? Why does he have so many horrible insults?
Well, yeah, it's crazy. It's like Don Rickles running for president. But one of the crazy things about his pathology is he's very proud of the fact that he got rid of all these Republican rivals by coming up with these belittling nicknames, you know, Lion Ted, Little Marco. But on the other hand, when someone insults him, he gets so hurt, mm-hmm. like a little kid, but he doesn't see the irony in that. He doesn't understand that he gets really hurt, but he doesn't understand why the Republicans that he puts down then don't turn around and support him. Like, he was very hurt that the Bushes wouldn't come to his convention. But he eviscerated Jeb Bush as low energy and belittled and emasculated him. But then he really couldn't understand why the Bushes weren't coming. He doesn't understand why they don't just turn around and love him.
And the comments about Ted Cruz's father, what in the world was that all about? That was just cruel. It was just cruel.
He is a conspiracy theorist.
He is. Hmm.
And Roger Stone, who's his top aide, is a conspiracy theorist. And, you know, they have a lot of nutty conspiracy theories going. And now the alt-right, who is helping to run his campaign, are conspiracy theorists, and they put out all this stuff about Hillary's health.
Right.
Plus, Trump is friends with David Pecker, who runs the National Enquirer, and they, you know, are conspiracy theorists. So the National Enquirer, just in the past week, has had a picture, a Photoshop picture on the cover of Hillary saying she gained 103 pounds on the campaign.
Oh, my gosh.
And another Photoshop one of Michelle saying she gained 95 pounds. And it's just, they're just, honestly, in an alternative universe, but we've never seen a situation where conspiracy theories had infiltrated the normal political, you know, arena. And actually, sort of now, these guys are running Trump's campaign.
Does Trump read the National Enquirer regularly?
Yes, he has a front, what do you call it, first person essay in there almost every week.
Does
about
he really?
How to make America great, and they pick up his nicknames for his rivals, like Lion Ted. And yeah, no, that is sort of a subsidiary of the Trump campaign.
You write about your sister's vote, that he lost her vote, Heidi, with the comments about Heidi Cruz. What did he say to that when you told him that?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I come from a family of conservatives, and so and they are kind of agonizing the way Paul Ryan is. How do we support our party, but, you know, support this person who is cozying up to the evil empire and insulting everyone? But I had told him that my sister was going to vote for him, and then in another interview, he goes, "Do I still have your sister?" And I said, "No, because you retweeted that unflattering picture of Heidi Cruz with the one about, you know, the pretty one of Melania." And he goes, "Oh, it wasn't that unflattering." And I said, "Yes, it was." I said, "Why don't you just apologize for it? It was wrong." And to my amazement, he apologized. And I got the first apology out of him. And he goes, "If that will get your sister's vote again." And she did an essay for the book, and she's still agonizing. You know, she goes back and forth, and my brother did an essay, and so was he. And after the incident with the Khan family at the convention, my brother called me and goes, "Can you kill my essay?" But I said, "It was too late. The book has gone to press." But that's the problem with Trump. You're sort of really held hostage to the volatility and whims of the 70-year-old kite chair king.
Yeah. Well, let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. Maureen Dowd is our guest this hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist. She reads the, you know, you read it every week, right? The Sunday New York Times columnist. And so this book will guide you through this election in an alarming way and in a very entertaining and enlightening way as well. The book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics by Pulitzer Prize winning columnist Maureen Dowd. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We're on Facebook if you want to go there, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. To you in a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Maureen Dowd is our guest, and we have lots of calls coming in. We start with Connie in Madison. Hi, Connie.
Hi. What a privilege to talk to you, Maureen. I was recently watching the long 4 hours long ago special on the American Experience on John F. Kennedy, and it spent about an hour to an hour and a half on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I appreciated, again, for the manyth time, the incredible strength of his temperament in restraining the very furious generals, including Curtis LeMay, in that very terrible time of suspense and ambiguity, and was a large enough person that he found a way to give Khrushchev a face-saving way out of the impasse by quietly saying, I'll take the missiles out of Turkey if you take the missiles out of Cuba. And Khrushchev wrote a note to him somehow acknowledging this and then signed it respectfully, Khrushchev, and later went on to negotiate that very first arms treaty. I am just, I was transposing in my mind Donald Trump for John F. Kennedy, and I would love your thought on a situation like that where restraint and prudence is everything in a negotiation. And I'll listen off the air.
Thanks, Connie.
Connie, that's so funny because I was mesmerized by those two and actually been sent away for some of the ones I missed on Truman. And I was comparing LBJ and Obama because, you know, they're so different. Like, LBJ was right in the fray all the time with the elbow grease, and Obama likes to stay above the fray. But on temperament, you know, Truman said that you never know how a man is going to take the responsibility of president until they become president. But with Trump, it is obviously very worrisome because he, you know, they call him the Siberian candidate because he seems to be so easily flattered by Putin. And I asked him about that, about being malleable, but I think he misunderstood what I was saying and thought I was saying flexible and thought it was a compliment. But the thing about Putin is Republicans are completely flummoxed by this because, you know, usually their stance has been complete, you know, skepticism of the Soviet Union, and now they all have to twist and turn to defend a nominee who is praising the Soviet Union. And Mike Pence, who's been very critical of Putin, is twisting himself into a pretzel trying to defend Trump. And so many things are upside down. And then you've got the, you know, the Democratic candidate who's cozying up to Wall Street. So that's right. The exact opposite of where they, you know, the Bernie Sanders people want to be. But, you know, when I went to Cuba with Obama, and when we got to the airport, for the Cubans were just very disorganized in the trip, and Obama was trying to almost guide the Cubans through the trip. But Raul Castro didn't come to the airport. And so Trump immediately begins tweeting, if that were me, I'd turn the plane around. And so then when Obama, but then the trip went very well, actually. But then, so then Obama went to China, and the Chinese were really rude to him and made him go through the stairs in the belly of the plane, which was really rude. And so Trump begins tweeting, I would turn the plane around. So, you know, it is, you know, there is no impulse control. But the example with Putin proves that he has subjugated every decision to his ego. So it isn't Republican ideology. It isn't, you know, his party's correct stance. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But it's like a little boy in school saying, he likes me, so I like him. But again, it would probably change in 1 second, because the most hilarious thing is that Stephen Lee Myers on our staff and other Russian experts have explained that probably the word was mistranslated, that it doesn't really mean Putin didn't really say that Trump was brilliant. He said he was flashy. So this whole thing been for naught, you know?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I really like David Axelrod, and I think that you probably do, too.
Yeah, he's a good friend.
Is he? Yeah, I love your quoting him in the book. And I want to have you respond to this. Axelrod says, and you quote him in the book, there was a susceptibility to a guy like Trump coming along, the perfect antithesis of Obama, defiantly, gleefully anti-intellectual. Can you talk more about that? Do you agree that it was there was a susceptibility and why?
That's why I love Axelrod, because he just says things that are really true, even if people are going to get mad at him. But that's such an interesting question, because, you know, without W, you couldn't have had Obama, and without Obama, you couldn't have had Trump, because W went so far in making the United States a hyperpower and making the worst foreign policy mistake in modern history or history with Iraq that it set the stage for this young, not very experienced, attractive senator from Illinois to come along, and his issue was arguing against the Iraq War. And so that's what elevated him and helped him beat Hillary Clinton. And then it turned out he was a constitutional law professor and very nuanced, and then the right wing got mad. They thought he was leading from behind and, you know, was this Nobel Prize winning global leader rather than a strong American leader. So as David said, you know, people got tired of all the nuance that they had wanted after the black and white W. So then that set the stage for sort of a strongman type like Trump. But here is the really weird final twist to this, which is, W's whole thing with Iraq was he thought he could get rid of some of these strong men in the Middle East, you know, and make it more democratic, which was just this naive thing he had. So he actually set the stage for a lot of these angry Americans wanting a strong man. So the whole thing is crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. You know, it got me thinking when you wrote, I love this line that you have in the wives of Bill Clinton and also of Barack Obama, you have Hillary, just as educated as Bill was, Michelle certainly just as educated, and I know people who worked with Michelle in Chicago and Bill and really thought she was the one who would run for president. Wouldn't it have been, it's just interesting to think about, what if Hillary had run and become president instead of Bill, and what if Michelle had become president instead of Barack?
That's so interesting because, you know, when Barack first started running and people would introduce him and say, oh, he's a Harvard, you know, law degree at this, he would sometimes look over at Michelle very guiltily. And then when he got to the microphone, he'd say, well, my wife has the exact same credentials.
Right.
And then she has to go into this antiquated first lady role, which has never been updated. And she actually, unlike Hillary, did not chafe against it. She just kind of went with it. And she, I think she's just done an amazing, flawless job. I mean, she could have tried to be an Eleanor Roosevelt, but I think they felt like they had enough on their plate, you know, as the first African-American couple, and she was going to try and work within the constraints of this ridiculous antediluvian job, and she's done a brilliant job, I think. But I read several biographies of Hillary over the weekend, and I went over my own book when I started covering her in 92, and I was so supportive of her when she was running as Bill's wife, mm-hmm. you know, because this first lady job is such a ridiculous tightrope for a modern woman. And then when she, you know, started with healthcare, which is basically 16% of our government, I had my doubts because, you know, if you have an unelected person or an unappointed person doing it, and she's the president's wife, will people have the nerve to tell her if things are going wrong? And, you know, I was very supportive on that, too, but then they didn't. And she did that in a very secretive way, my way or the highway way, that ended up scuttling it. But all through her, you know, the biographies of her, that strain that you're talking about was there because, you know, all of her girlfriends said she should have, she got more famous than him quickly because she made that famous Wellesley speech,
mm-hmm.
and that she could have run on her own and not hitched her star to his. you know, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Those couples have the exact same credentials, educational credentials. But, you know, that's why everybody really wants to see Bill Clinton as first black. Because, and Hillary has said she put him in charge of the economy and that Chelsea could do some hostessing duties and that Hillary would continue to pick out the China. But I wish she would let him do the traditional duties, because I think that would really underscore how antediluvian the job is.
Yeah, oh, that's a great comment. Christine in Franklin, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, why are so many of our presidents and elects, you know, in their 70s, elderly? If you worked in a private corporation, when you became retirement age, they were kind of pushed out.
I lost you for a second. You're talking about the presidential candidate?
Yes. Why they're, you know, if you were 70 and you're in a private company, you'd be pushed out.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, that's part of this whole health issue that has come up this week. But I think that people, that was part of Barack Obama's appeal, because he was young and fresh and we were going to modernize and look toward Asia and everything, globalized and everything. But somehow we've been, you know, it's like the line from Gatsby, born back ceaselessly into the past, because the mistakes with Iraq and Afghanistan are so bad that they have overshadowed Obama's presidency. And Hillary, I just think she felt that Obama, the young prince, had usurped her right. So she wanted to run this time. And, yeah, she's 68.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to John and Shauna next. Hello, John.
Oh, hello, Kathleen and Maureen, is it?
It's Maureen Dowd, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. I have not read your book. So, hey,
Out yesterday.
So you'll have... it's just out yesterday.
I'd like to... can you hear me?
Yes, we just wanted to let you know it just came out yesterday, John, so you can get it. You have time to read the book.
Oh, I'm... Okay.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Okay.
But, your book goes past the latest election, does it not?
And No. It's almost like a voter's guide, because I've covered these two candidates since the 90s. And here's the weird thing. They're two of the most famous people on the planet, mm-hmm. and yet nobody feels that they know who they are. And in the case of both the candidates, they keep getting reintroduced every weekend. And the memos that Hillary was getting from her staff in the 90s, which were, you've really got to show the real Hillary, are the same memos she's getting now. And they're still trying to reintroduce her. So I was hoping that if I could show a narrative arc starting in the 90s to now, it would help people understand who they are.
Mm-hmm. I think you should tell us the fish story in Alaska. I've never heard it before, and I think she should tell it on the campaign trail.
Yes, that's a really interesting story. When she was running as the wife of Bill Clinton in 92, I had dinner with her at a revolving restaurant in Kentucky. And we had white wine, and she was very charming. And it was before some of her defenses were up, but not to the point they were now, where she didn't have a press conference for a year. You know, but she still was willing to talk to the press. And funnily enough, when she does talk to the press, our Hill reporters, Capitol Hill reporters, and our State Department reporters really respected her and loved hanging out with her, and she would have a drink with the State Department reporters when they were on trips. So when she exposed herself more, they really got along with her well. It's when she walls herself off that the problems with the press begin. But anyway, so we're having dinner in this revolving restaurant, and she was telling me that at Yale Law School, she had this job in the summer at an Alaska fish sliming place, where she realized that the fish were purple and black and yucky looking. And she went to the owner and said, you know, these fish are old and should not be sold. And he pushed back and was like, you know, stay out of it, don't tell anyone. And she pushed back and quit. And, you know, there is that pure side of her that mm-hmm. really wants to do good. And if only she could rediscover that side, I think, and be more open and less defensive, I think she could help herself a lot.
Maureen Dowd is our guest this hour. Her book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, probably the best ever at what she does. She's really terrific. Maureen Dowd is our guest. She won a Pulitzer for her series of columns on the Clinton impeachment and Monica Lewinsky scandal. She has covered not just for this campaign, but she's covered Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump for quite some time, so you get a perspective on earlier people, so you don't have to be reintroduced to them all the time. She will introduce you to them some years ago. Our phone number, lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation with Maureen, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We have some messages on email we'll get to in just a moment. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jack in Eagle River is next. Hello, Jack.
Hi. Just I'll preface this by saying I'm not a Trump supporter. Just curious what Maureen's understanding or explanation or insight on why Hillary Clinton has not had press conferences for all mm-hmm. these months. That's all.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
I'm sorry, did you say you were not a Trump supporter?
Yes, he's not a Trump supporter.
Not a Trump supporter. Why she hasn't? You know, I think it's a complete lost opportunity for her because, we have a joke around our office because whenever you talk to people who are close to Hillary Clinton, they always say the same thing to me or to anyone, like, I wish you could get to know her better in an informal situation mm-hmm. because she's a hoot in private. So we always say to each other, she's a hoot in private. But, and I know I'm sure she has that side of her. I've heard she has a good sense of humor. And I know from our Hill reporters and State Department reporters, there was a really funny story. Our State Department reporter, Mark Landler, who has a book out called Alter Egos about Hillary and Obama's relationship, told about how they were traveling abroad. She had to meet with her, when she was Secretary of State, she had to meet with her counterpart, her Chinese counterpart. And she had been out with the reporters and had a tequila sunrise. And so they were worried that maybe she would be a little fuzzy. So Mark brought a tequila sunrise over to the Chinese foreign minister so that it would even out the playing field. But that's how much they liked her, that they were protective of her. Mm. So I just think that because of all the scar tissue, starting with, you know, she had a hard time with reporters in Arkansas, but then really starting with Whitewater and Travelgate, they had all of this mishigas all through. And I think she just built up this defense, you know, wall against the press. Everything is the war room. She doesn't like the press. She, you know, but unfortunately, the effect of that is that it tends to make things snowball. Like with Whitewater, for instance, George Stephanopoulos said in his memoir that if he could have a genie come out of a bottle and change one thing, it would be that he would try harder to convince Hillary just to give the Washington Post the papers on Whitewater because he thinks the whole thing would have gone away in a week. And instead, it ended up snowballing into 7 independent counsel investigations of the White House. Mm-hmm. It cost the taxpayers $80 million, and it ended up in this stupid impeachment thing. And so there's something about her defensiveness and war room and don't tell anybody anything and appearing and disappearing records that causes things to snowball that would be nothing, like the pneumonia thing. Of course, everyone thinks that candidates get sick.
Sure.
But when you mislead people, then it creates,
right.
you know, this snowballing effect.
Yeah. From an email from a caller, I don't find Donald Trump's rise amusing or funny. I'm scared.
Yes, That's what Hillary said at a fundraiser recently, that she is the only thing standing between us and the abyss. A friend of mine, Leon Wieseltier, you know, a magazine editor, calls it Trump a national emergency. And a lot of people feel this way. And my only point about this is, I'm not comparing them, but I don't think it helped Hillary Clinton to put her above reproach. However, you know, reproachful Donald Trump is, it doesn't help her, it doesn't help us, it doesn't help democracy. She has to be accountable as well.
Let's go. Jack, thanks for your call. We go to John in Wausau. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to ask Maureen about what she thinks about racism in the presidential race. After President Obama got elected, I heard so many racist things about him and his family from people, from high school graduates to PhDs. I just couldn't believe it. And I read a while back about an article that somebody wrote about that a lot of white people are concerned because they realize a minority of white people and a majority of minorities can elect a president of a different color. And I just wonder how prevalent you think that that is in the country right now.
That's a great question. I think a lot of people who voted for Barack Obama felt very good about, you know, where we stood as a country, that we had made that step. And I think that perhaps it was underestimated. You know, if you saw Fantasia and the night on Bald Mountain where all the spirits come out of the mountain, I think that the election of an African-American president and a woman running have unleashed a lot of latent sexism and racism. And if you watch a Donald Trump rally online and look at the scrolling comments next to it about Hillary Clinton, every time I see them, they are so horrific. Mm. It makes me want to go sign up and work for her campaign. Mm. I mean, that's how horrible it is. But, you know, we just have to hope that I would just like to say one thing, because my siblings have essays about voting for Trump in this book. Not everyone who supports Trump is a racist or, you know, I think American voters, the ones who are really angry right now, have a right to be angry because the economy almost collapsed. And a lot of Americans had never heard the word derivative. Mm-hmm. We went into a war that we are, two wars that we're still in, and a lot of Americans don't even still understand the tribal problems between Sunni and Shia. So, you know, they were told how great globalization was, and it isn't. A lot of people are suffering. So I think people have a right to be angry and to think Washington is dysfunctional because it is dysfunctional. So, yes, there is a lot of racism and sexism, but there is also a lot of genuine anger, and rightfully so.
I was pleased to see in your book, we just interviewed Gene Edward Smith, isn't that his name, yesterday on W.
Yes,
George W.
and he's the one who described Iraq as the worst foreign policy mistake in history. Yes, yeah. I agree with his book. And I have an essay in my book. I went back and re-reported the father-son relationship, the Bushes, and about Iraq. And I spent a lot of time on this, and I'm really proud of it. And I use all the letters from Bush Sr. that he wrote me. And, you know, it is one of the most amazing episodes in American history. And it sort of matches what that historian says.
Mm-hmm. From another email, since both candidates, Maureen, are so unpopular, could this be the VP picks who carry the election?
No, I think, you know, yeah, it that's another depressing thing about this year, because people are voting against someone, not for someone. And the voters are, Peggy Noonan had a great line. She said it was voters are veering between anxiety over Trump and depression over Hillary. And, you know, it's just sad, especially after the tulip craze of 2008, where everyone was so excited and we thought we were moving into this new modern era, that now everyone feels like, you know, they can only vote against someone, not for someone.
Yeah. Let's go to Janet in Oconomowoc. Hello, Janet.
Hello. Hi, Maureen. I'm so happy to speak with you. I was listening to the radio this morning and heard the teasers that you were going to be on, and my mom and I were just talking over the weekend how we miss your columns in the Milwaukee Journal. Do you know why they're not running your column anymore?
Well, you can find them in my book.
Yes, you can, Janet.
The publisher keeps telling me to mention the book, but yeah, buy the book.
Okay. Well, so my question is, this whole, you're just talking about the Shias and the Sunnis. You had a column years ago when GW was our president, and you defined the differences between them. You kind of gave us an education, and more of a compliment. Thank you very much for educating us and being a journalist that doesn't pick a side. I had no idea you were from a Republican family because you're so even when you take on either major party.
Well, you know, at first I didn't think it was going to work because up until that point, all columnists came from one ideology or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But I had been a political reporter for a really long time, so I wanted to try and do it from that perspective. But I think it's really hard for Times readers even now sometimes, and my family too, because when a Democrat's in, my family's crazy about me. But when a Republican's in, they're not.
No.
And one of my brothers, you know, it makes family gatherings hard sometimes. And one of my brothers, you know, got mad at me when I wrote for 7 years about the lead up and then the Iraq War and how it was such a mess. And he said to me very angrily at a Thanksgiving dinner, you know, if there was a hurricane, you'd blame W for it. And then there was Katrina, and I did.
Maureen. They have to be really prepared to do battle with you, though, right?
They don't care what I think at all. They never ask my opinion. It's a very large, opinionated, noisy Irish Catholic family.
What about this moment? And you write this in the book, there have been moments of wicked fun with Trump. The second part of the question is, have there ever been with you with Hillary? And what are the moments of wicked fun with Trump?
It was at the beginning before the kind of hate took over. But what I liked about Trump was at the very beginning, he kind of knocked over the golden apple cart of greedy, you know, political consultants who make all this money off of political campaigns, and he was doing it all out of his back pocket, not spending money and doing his own ads on Instagram. And, you know, it was just fun to see all of those people. And also, he's kind of showed up the hypocrisy of some Republicans who often had used racism and misogyny and homophobia to drive votes, but they liked it more subtle than Trump was doing it. And also I did like the fact that he was honest about the Iraq War and how that was not a good idea and that we weren't on the ball before 9/11. So that's why all these neocons are supporting Hillary, because she's the hawk, really, and Trump is kind of a little bit more of a dove.
Mm. Let's go one more call. We have less than a minute. Werner in Arborvita. Hi.
Hi. That was pretty interesting, the last...
we'll have to be quick about this. We're almost out of time.
All right. Hillary, I think, has been taken advantage of because she's a woman, and she's been under scrutiny for so long.
All right. Maureen?
And what's the question?
That she's held to a different kind of standard. She's been under scrutiny for so long, and she's female and held to a different standard.
Yes, I agree. I mean, but on the other hand, as I say, she does get in this unhealthy symbiosis where she brings some of this stuff on herself by being so defensive. You know, but you're right, being you know, as I say, when I see some of this sexist stuff that's said about her. But I think part of the problem was in 2008, Mark Penn told her to run as a man because if he put it in a famous memo, you know, they don't call it the father of the country for nothing. No. And so now she's running very much as a woman.
I need to hold you there.
And Lena Dunham, and you know, she has to be careful just not to call sexism on every.
Thank you, Maureen. We're out of time. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Kathleen, thanks.
Yeah,
bye.
Thanks. The book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. Pulitzer Prize winning columnist Maureen Dowd. Thanks to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley.